Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Unafawakin.
This week, Chinese hackers infiltrate U.S. newspaper networks. Twitter also got hacked. Oreo takes advantage of the Super Bowl blackout. Is Netflix's full season release schedule the future of television or a big mistake? Will your body be the next unlimited storage device? And if you thought J.J. Abrams hit the motherlode last week for helming both Star Trek and Star Wars franchises, you ain't heard nothing yet. So let's just jump into these stories here. So this one, first one right off the bat is just a follow-up to one that we talked about a couple weeks ago. At the 2013 CES convention, CNET's editorial staff loved the Dishhopper DVR and nominated Best in Show. That journalistic decision was quickly tossed out, however, by the legal department at CBS, CNET's corporate parent, because they're involved in litigation against Dish over the Hopper. The censoring of CNET's decision has produced a fair bit of fallout for CBS already. Greg Sandoval, a well-known writer for CES, left the company saying he's concerned that his employer didn't respect editorial independence. We tended to agree with him here on The Drill Down. Now CES itself has put out a press release slamming CNET's behavior and announcing that CNET won't be allowed to produce the Best of CES awards anymore. Those awards are produced by CNET under contract with the Consumer Electronics Association, which puts on CES. The CEA said it'll work to identify a new partner to run the Best of CES awards. So there you go. The other shoe is dropped.
Well, I mean, the fact that they thought they could do it with impunity. I don't know if they thought that they could do it with impunity. I don't know if this is a calculated risk, but I'm sure CBS is far more focused on the money it thinks it's going to get from this lawsuit, or the money it thinks it's going to actually be able to retain from maintaining the traditional way of watching TV if this lawsuit is successful for them.
Yeah. But I think it's overall an indication of the way people are watching TV. And, you know, we've seen from experience with situations like this that if you are bucking the popular trend, then you're going to get steamrolled. You're going to get steamrolled by progress. So don't try and fight it. Try and
work
with
it. At least
where
tech is concerned, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And you know what? Props to them for taking a stance. Props to CS for, you know, having an opinion and sticking by it. I am curious, you know, if this is – part of me thinks that it could also be – you know, now that you are in the limelight, you have to do something for CES.
Right. Yeah, but what's the pressure like on CES? But then again, Viacom is a humongous organization. So, and CES is, you know, it has a lot of press, but it's not exactly, it's nothing compared to Viacom. So it does take some guts to be able to stand up to them.
Uh-huh. All right, moving on here. For the last 4 months, Chinese hackers have persistently attacked the New York Times, infiltrating its computer systems and getting passwords for its reporters and other employees. The timing of the attacks coincided with the reporting for a Times investigation published online on October 25th that found the relatives of Wen Jiabao, China's prime minister, had accumulated a fortune worth several billion dollars through business dealings. The hackers tried to cloak the source of the attack on the Times by first penetrating computers at U.S. universities and routing the attacks through them. This matches the subterfuge used in many other attacks tracked to China. The attackers first installed malware that enabled them to gain entry to any computer on the Times network. The malware was identified by computer security experts as a specific strain associated with computer attacks originating in China. More evidence of the source, experts says, is that attacks started from the same university computers used by the Chinese military to attack U.S. military contractors in the past. And one day after the New York Times reported that Chinese hackers infiltrated their computers, the Wall Street Journal announced that they too have been hacked. It said that hackers had broken into its network through computers in its Beijing bureau. The Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, said that a global effort was needed to establish the rules of the road for cyber activity. We've seen over the last years an increase in not only the hacking attempts on government institutions, but also non-governmental ones, Mrs. Clinton said. The Chinese, she said, are not the only people who are attacking us.
Bum, bum, bum! It's funny because we have this online community, and it's online, like we're all one and all happy and kumbaya on the internet because we can all talk. But different countries, and not even different countries, you know, China's a big country, and they have different factions. And who knows what, you know, which elements, if this is like, you know, Wang Jiabao saying, no, this has to stop, shut them down. Or if it's just some minister of his who knows that who is trying to protect him because he's so important to them or whatever. We don't know what's going on over there. But as big as the internet is in terms of like bringing people together, the rules are different. There are cultures who are different. There are people who are going to use it to their advantage in ways that, you know, go completely against the openness. And just like how, you know, for us, that's what it says, completely against the openness. But just like how we look at like some of what Anonymous does, and we think that their motives might be admirable, despite the fact that their tactics are, you know, not good. I think there are people in China who probably think the same way. They're like, why are you trying to embarrass our leader? Remember, they don't have freedom of the press over there. So us laying out, you know, the New York Times is going to do what it can. It's going to do what it can to make sure that it reports, you know, things that are true and correct. But if you're living in China or North Korea or any of these places that doesn't have access to free speech, access to freedom of the press, you know, this is the first time you're ever hearing that the person who's been vaunted as the most awesome person in your world, you know, could possibly be doing something wrong. And that's going to be something that I think the public sentiment, it could cause, you know, public sentiment might be behind such efforts. Like, yeah, do that. Take those Americans out. They have no respect. That kind of thing.
Are we in the midst of a cyber cold war, or is this just an indication that it's been going on for a long time and we're just – this is just one of the major sort of milestones in that?
It's one of the major milestones. Yeah.
I mean, what's cold?
Did you see War Games? You know, this is just the start of it. This is War Games, the sequel. I guess, since the – well, we'll call it sequel since I don't think the actual sequel counted. But yeah, no, I mean this is – I'm sure this has been going on for a long time before. It's only that we're actually catching on and reporting about it, because often it's cases like these where the corporations which are hit keep it hush-hush, primarily because it's just bad PR, saying that you were infiltrated and you were successfully infiltrated, especially by another company. So – or another entity, another country is what I meant to say. So I highly believe that this has been ongoing for a long time, and it's going to continue. It's going to escalate. More news places are going to report about it. But we'll see how well our defenses are and how well it holds. I mean,
is it the defenses of these particular like private organizations? Because, I mean, the thing is one thing that's truly bad is that it really ups the cost of doing business when you have to worry about foreign governments infiltrating your systems and you know, turning your computers off. You can't it's already hard enough to make money without having to worry about the power and wealth of a foreign government trying to undermine your ability to produce your product.
So, I think I mean in by our, I'm not necessarily meaning corporation, but I'm or even countrywide, but I just mean in general as technology is. So by our, I mean the companies that produce, you know, firewalls, that produce antiviruses, anti-malware, that go out and do deployments for organizations. And so I think that has far larger reaches. I mean, if you recall, there was the whole episode about the U.S. Releasing – I can't remember what it was, but it was literally a virus in an Iran facility. Mm-hmm. Is that what it was? So, I mean, how long ago was that? That was a while ago, and I think these things just continue to happen, and
And it was alleged that we released, that the United States government or whoever was responsible for that. There's no, I don't think there's any evidence that, that says for sure that it was us. Just like this Chinese thing is also alleged. We have indicators that it could be, you know, from China, but we don't have any, like, there hasn't been any kind of court of law that says you guys were bad and you did this or whatever. So it's alleged.
Yeah, we do hear about these things from time to time every so often. And Anonymous just hacked the Fed recently too, and released some sensitive documents on bank executives. So it's hard enough to keep our people in our own country from hacking our sensitive government sites, as let alone foreign countries.
Yeah, I mean, hey, it's a lot easier to do it from the internet. Mm-hmm. Rather than having to actually be on premise. Not that it's impossible, because lots of people are able to, you know, easily sneak on in, follow, you know, impersonate another person, do social engineering tactics. But in combination, you have systems which are on for 24/7 and a lot of time to attempt different mechanisms to infiltrate. I mean, it's the same sort of mentality that we see even in the consumer market with, you know, jailbreaking your iPhone, right? That was a whole cat and mouse pursuit, and eventually, you know, they were able to discover something. It's probably a similar sort of approach or tactic that occurs when it also comes to you know, digging through company information.
Yeah.
Speaking of hacking, Twitter disclosed on Friday evening that its systems had been attacked in the past week by an unidentified group of hackers. As a result of the attack, the hackers may have had access to the usernames, email addresses, and other sensitive information of nearly a quarter of a million Twitter users. On Friday evening, Twitter sent out emails to those users whose accounts may have been compromised, notifying them that the company had automatically reset their passwords and that they need to create a new password in order to access the service again. And guess what, guys? I got that email. So this is like literally since I started recording the drill down, this is probably the 8th or 9th time that a service that I have subscribed to has been hacked and compromised.
I don't get how they get the passwords. Aren't the passwords encrypted? Aren't they sitting like in an encrypted file an encrypted hard drive? You know, like, I don't understand how these plain text, like, I get with Sony, they were really the worst because the plain text credit card numbers and passwords were part of the URL. But here, I just don't get how. When I say I don't get it, I mean, I'm not saying it in a cynical, facetious kind of like, why are they so stupid kind of way. I just don't get how encrypted passwords are retrieved. Like, I would imagine that, okay, they got the files that have these passwords in them,
but
they're in SHA-256 or some crazy you know, shit like that. So they, you know, they won't be able to decode them.
Yes.
We're going to ask you to change your password anyway, just in case these people decide to leverage the entire Amazon EC2 community in order to break your passwords at a rate of one per year. You know, like,
wouldn't you rather that they be that overly cautious then?
Yeah, safer rather than sorry, right?
I just want to know if, in fact, like, whenever I hear these things, it makes me wonder, is my stuff encrypted on their servers? Or
they claim that it was.
They don't tell you that, right?
Twitter claimed that the passwords were encrypted and salted. So, you know, but I think this is just a precautionary measure. Just everybody change their password just in case.
That really sucks if you, like, I don't know, like, as an iOS user. Twitter had me, like, reset my password once, and, like, you know, I had to go to every fucking separate device, part of my language. And I would, you know, you'd forget. You forget that you were told to set your to fix your stuff.
Uh-huh.
So you're on your Mac, and you're, like, you know, doing stuff. Oh, I'm going to tweet this because it's all built in. Oh, it doesn't work. Wait, what? You're on your iPad. Oh, it doesn't work. You're on your iPhone. Oh, it doesn't work. You're on your iPod Touch. Oh, it doesn't work. It sucks.
You have to go around and reset everything. Ugh.
Yeah, well, that. Rather Personal there problem. Than like you know, credit card or
this is true.
Things of that nature. And, you know, I think I know we've previously had a conversation about password vaults, but this is kind of the place that I find it one of the most useful mechanisms that I can just be like, oh, new random generated one.
So what happens when Dropbox there. Is hacked and your password vault that's using a file on Dropbox is compromised?
See, that's why I don't store it on Dropbox. I store it on Box.
But what happens when Box gets hacked and your password – I mean it's proven that any service can get hacked now. Any service, right? There's no – you know, if either Bulgarians or Chinese people or people inside the inside our own country, whatever, you know, hacking happens. So what I'm saying is when you have your password file on the cloud like that, Tosin, and that service does get hacked – and that file does get retrieved, do you then have to use your password vault to create all new passwords and change password?
I mean, I could definitely go ahead and do that. Also, a part of the password vault that you have the ability to enable, if you choose to, is the same thing where, you know, if you put in a couple wrong attempts, it will completely wipe itself out and, you know, get rid of everything. Now, ability of... It all depends on how.
Has anyone ever
how
used
safe
that
you to, feel?
Has anyone ever used that to in like a positive way? I've never thought that you know, if someone should break into my phone, I want my phone completely wiped. I don't know, or my computer completely wiped.
I think in some like high level circumstances, that is the case.
As an individual, I'm not saying as a. As someone who's running a vast corporate empire, not that I'm doing that, or someone who's running an awesome government or something. I'm just saying, as an individual, I don't think I've ever thought to myself, man, if I get the password wrong 10 times, it should wipe it out because all my shit's in there. It's never happened. It's never appealed to me.
I would say probably like 98% of individuals would not enable something like that on like their mobile device, but I could definitely there are circumstances and it's really all about how safe you feel in general with anything, right? So even with cloud storage or with just even doing your billing online, right? So it's all a magnitude of what you are comfortable with.
All right.
And you know, at some point I don't know. It may also be me, but at some point with some of these things, you just have to accept the way it is. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't try and improve, but you have to accept that there is some innate percentage chance that certain you know things could occur. For example, the Twitter password, the salted
Twitter hacking
and
Zappos happening, all that shit, yeah.
Right, but the salted and encrypted passwords being released and someone – you know, you have to accept that certain chance that, you know, someone could potentially, you know, decrypt it, although it's a very, very small percent, very, very small chance that could occur, right? So
seems to be, like, I've accepted that reality almost a dozen times now.
Poor Andy.
I'm like a magnet for these.
I personally did not get that email, but I would recommend that you change your password anyway because it doesn't really hurt.
Sure, sure.
It does though because you know how people are. You know how people are. You've got that password. you thought of that password back in 1998 and you're like, that is my password. When I go to anything, I don't know what the password is. It's one of like three That's how people are. It's one of like three or four passwords. It's either my mom's birthday or it's that dog I used to have, or whatever it is. So when you have to like change it, like people are like, I've seen it. I've seen it in my office. I've seen it in my office when individuals have to change their password for because Microsoft or the Microsoft portal has made it so that you have to change it every 6 months, and they're just like, oh, like these are people who are like creative people, right? They're designing web pages and stuff, but the creativity stops when it comes to creating a new password. They're just like, oh, I'm never gonna remember. And the thing is, it's not that they're like you know just completely like spoiled brats, but what happens is they go and they change their password because they have to, because they won't be able to log in tomorrow without doing it. They change it, the password expired, they change it, And like 2 weeks later, they're standing in front of the system administrator saying, I don't know, I changed it. I forgot what it was. You know, it automatically logs me in. And then I was online. I don't really know what happened. And it's all because people have these passwords that they've had ever since they got their first online account.
Yeah.
And they continue to use them.
Yeah.
So as much as you're supposed to, you're really supposed to be able to be like, let me look around my room, figure something out, and just make one or whatever your tactic is, or use the password vault systems that like Christopher Brenor and Tosin Adafuwa can use. It really hurts a lot of people to change their password. Like it's something we can't take for granted.
That's true, but it's something which we really need to better ourselves. We need to accept it and really work hard to like. I mean, it's one thing to. On one hand, it's very simple, very easy to create simplistic passwords and, you know, not really care about it. But you'll start caring when something negative happens to you. And although, you know, it may be a small chance and a small percentage of people where it does hit home, you know, it's really keep yourself safe.
Yeah, I mean, this is why Google is trying to get rid of the password by making it like, you know, your eye or some other aspect of the camera recognition, whatever, two-pronged. You know, you have to put the code every week or month or whatever. You have to use the code from your cell phone in addition to your whatever. And yeah, I feel like this is I want the Star Trek thing. I want to be like DeFreitas Alpha Bravo 4 and have all my shit work. That way, it needs my voice imprint as well as some funny thing I have to say, right? Like DeFreitas, the rain in Spain falls mostly in the plains, you know? And like that's what it needs to be, because that way someone can hear your password. It doesn't matter. It's out there. Mm. But they can't actually use it because it's a question of the two-pronged fact of your voice.
Right.
And your and what you're saying. You know, that kind of thing.
And I think that's also why it's important to, you know, some of the services, at least for some of your core services, if you have the option to, you definitely should enable two-factor.
Is so much work, two-factor. Oh. What if I don't have my phone with me? And yeah, I'm like... Yeah, that's ridiculous. Two factors.
It's so much safer. Like I know people who have had issues.
Oh, it's 1,000 times safer. Probably like mathematically, it's, you know, I'm sure there's like they can multiply it by crazy. What I'm saying is that these are not approaches that normal people ever want to do. And it's not about moving the technology. It's not about moving someone toward a technology. It's about moving technology towards someone. The reason why we're in this wonderful world of social and mobile technology is because for a long time, you know, the computer was strapped to the computer was stuck inside the humongous box, and we had to know commands to move around. And the web was designed, you know, for people who knew about webmasters, domains, you know, these funky words that only people who love Dungeons and Dragons understand.
Demons.
They were the people that the web was made for. But when social came out the way it has, and mobile came out in a manner that allows people to use their get connected anywhere without thinking about what it means to be connected, and that's the fall to the wayside, then we get real growth. We get real economic opportunity. We get all this stuff. And I feel like the authentication technology, the passing of my credentials to get to the services that I want, needs to move in that direction. We need a change. We need to change the likes of which we saw when the slowest thing on the computer, the hard drive, was replaced by the SSD. We need to change that big. Something that allows people.
But I think also to a certain extent, you never know, because there are a lot of things that people used to hate, but now they love or they've accepted now. I think, like, even the cell phone could be put in that category.
That's because it became smart. That's why people love it now. Back when it was just a thing that bleeped and vibrated and sent you funny messages from people you didn't know, no one liked that thing. But then it got pictures and touch screens and kinetic scrolling.
It became a mini computer.
Yeah, and people didn't even think about it as a computer. They think about it as just like, it's my thing. I sleep with it. I take a poop with it. I do whatever. I wish it could go in the shower with me. But... You know,
so we need to add like lolcats to passwords and make it a little
password memes.
Password memes.
That's your two factor. What is the meme on memeoftheday.com plus your voice? That's your password.
My voice is my passport. Verify me.
Exactly.
So did you guys watch the Super Bowl this last weekend?
I watched the end of it. When I sat down, the 49ers were down like 3 to some number. And then within 4 or 5 minutes, they were almost winning.
Did you watch it socially online with the Facebook and Twitter and such?
On Facebook and Twitter, yeah, absolutely.
So you, I'm sure you must have been aware of the power outage.
I was in the car when the power outage happened. I was coming back from a ski trip.
I think it was a transformer or some relay, some power relay tripped. And
it was Michael Bay.
Yeah, it was Bane.
it was those Chinese hackers.
Exactly.
I bet it was. And Michael Bay.
So when the power outage at the Superdome stopped the game between the Ravens and the 49ers for an epic 34 minutes, Oreo Cookies team took action and posted a simple ad that was retweeted more than 14,500 times on Twitter.
And you'd be really careful about who you call an Oreo.
The message read, power out, no problem. You can still dunk in the dark. So how did they respond to the ad so quickly? The company, the agency responsible for the ad, 360i, said, because Oreo was a Super Bowl advertiser, we had to set up a team of folks at our offices with people from Oreo as well to both listen and optimize the chatter on the internet. While we certainly didn't expect the blackout, the team's first instinct upon the blackout was to figure out how Oreo could be relevant in the moment. Having a full team of creative social media experts and the brand made it quick and seamless. Oreo's instant Twitter ad stood out on a night when 30-second ads on TV cost $3.8 million. It helped demonstrate the power of ingenuity over money and social media over traditional forms. It's likely part of a coming wave of real-time advertising that reacts like a political campaign war room to real-time events. I just wanted to kind of point
Hopefully
out...
better than a political campaign war room
yeah.
to real-time events.
Yeah. I just thought this was a fascinating story this week because it really is like a tribute to the constantly evolving state of social media and how you really have to... it's a benefit to you to be alive and reactive on the networks. It's kind of thing. This is like social media 101. This particular lesson should go down with, you know, the Old Spice guy on YouTube and other sort of highly engaging
101 or Hall of Fame?
Hall of Fame, I'll say.
Hall of Fame, yeah.
Yeah, because that's it's a very advanced maneuver. You have to have a team of social media experts, yeah. Which a lot of brands, I mean, everyone knows that things are moving to social. I think that maybe one day we won't call it social media. It'll be media because media will have changed. But the idea of an army of social media experts just sitting there around right now, not a lot of ROI there. I mean, we still haven't been able to crack advertising on Facebook. What we're really seeing is earned media beating out paid media, right? Like the idea that you can put something together that's so magnetic that people want to spread it for you. And that's how you get – that's why it's earned, because you didn't do it by giving some publisher a ton of money, not even Facebook. You didn't give Facebook or Twitter any money. But those followers are reacting to what you have to say in meaningful ways that are engaged across the platform, and they're communicating with one another, and therefore your message as an advertiser gets out. And I think this is, like you said, where things really need to go. And right now in the world that we're in, it's crises like this. So I'm using the word crisis very loosely, obviously. It was a power outage. Crises like this are what are places that can be capitalized on. But it's going to take some time before these brands have access to the type of talent and like the think tanks, because that's really what it is, right? You're a bunch of social media people sitting around, you know, on your computers in your respective places, and dude, what's going on? Yada yada yada, and then suddenly you communicate and get whatever. But you know, there's not a lot of ROI from this kind of thing to begin in the very beginning. So I think it's going to take some time for it to really take off. But I think you're absolutely right. This is an example of the power of real time earned media for branding.
Okay, moving on here. So the last of our big headlines here before we get into our main topic. At this year's, and it's a doozy, So at this year's Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences DICE Summit, Star Trek and Star Wars Episode 7 director J.J. Abrams... He's back. And Valve Software head Gabe Newell announced that plans for movies based on Valve's Portal and Half-Life games are in the early stages, but that Abrams is personally interested in bringing those universes to film. It's as real as anything in Hollywood ever gets, Abrams said, which is that we're really talking to Valve. We're going to be bringing on a writer. We have a lot of very interesting ideas. And both the Portal and Half-Life movie are things I want to see, Abrams said. We're also aware of the cautionary tales of movies that became games and vice versa. Our goal here is to treat the world Valve has created in both of these properties like anyone would a book or some great story that comes from a pitch or original script. Just treat it with the respect they treat their games and their players with. Valve co-founder and president Gabe Newell expressed apprehension in the past about making movies based on Half-Life, saying that the developer would prefer to either make it themselves or just not make it at all. Abrams says he's also collaborating with Valve on a video game idea of his own, with no links to existing Valve properties like Half-Life Portal or Team Fortress or existing Bad Robot properties. One that explores, quote, the limits of gaming in a perfect way. He said, we're not looking to make a movie in the gaming world. We're not looking to impose what we do on that. We're looking forward to taking some of our strengths and collaborating with some of these incredible minds that make some of my favorite games. Just as I think they're looking forward to taking some of their stories and the universe for some of their games and applying it to movies. I think they need to both be approached very differently. So, I mean, I heard this news and I was like, I was in heaven.
My first thought is, J.J. Abrams, where does he get all this time from?
I don't know. Like,
well, he has a staff. When you're the CEO of a company, you have officers that help you get your stuff done. J.J. Abrams, as a producer, he's got his trusted individuals that he, as captains, that sure. He can, you know, no doubt, be able give you know, projects to fuel. The problem is, going back to last week, that oftentimes he might start something, but because he's moved on to the next thing already, the vision that he had originally isn't borne out in a way that is, shall we say, sustainable insofar as the audience is concerned, which is why the idea of a film is a great thing for a character like his, because he can... It's a finite thing. It's not like a series that has to go on for several years. And, you know, his attention can be turned to something else after he gets the critical stuff done. It could be brought back for his review and so on and so forth, which is why I think his films are better than his TV shows. So I think that you say, where does he get the time? When you're able to lend your name to move something forward, and when you're, I'll give it to him, he's a very innovative, creative person. His premises are incredibly innovative. So when you've got that kind of innovation, that's where you focus, right? You focus on that, and then you move. You have your people who are more of the hands-on guys, or the people who are able to take who you know or you can trust with your vision to take it to the next level, to take your concept and execute it. Those are the guys doing the heavy lifting, so to speak.
I can't tell you how long I've been waiting to hear news like this. Like in sort of gamer circles, there are two properties that have been sort of legends for a long time as ones that are ripe for conversion to a film. And that's the Halo property and the Half-Life series.
Wasn't there a Halo movie already?
No. Well, no.
Well, there was like an animated,
not a true a big screen Halo movie.
And so you're looking for a live action feature film.
You don't
respect the anime.
Well, no, we're talking about major motion picture here.
Sure. If it's not, The Spirits Within. Could that kind of thing satisfy you, or you need it to be more traditional?
No, but I'm talking about properties that have yet to be produced as feature films. There were two big ones that have been, you know, bandied about for a long time, and that's the Halo series and the Half-Life series. And Halo I could really care less about, because it's basically Space Marines and James Cameron has already done that with Aliens. Half-Life was the one that was really going to be the the true sort of hallmark, the one that will that that the it's the one video game property that I feel is so rich and dynamic and
you don't think the Half-Life is in many ways is derivative of the Doom universe?
I think like lumping it in as I think that's an oversimplification. Okay. I think what Half-Life brings, especially Half-Life 2, is such a rich experience that it was almost cinematic in and of itself. And to imagine that as being now translated to a big screen feature film is just an incredible achievement, I think, will be. And not to mention Portal, too. Having J.J. Abrams want to tackle Portal, too, I can imagine a movie that is a cross between, like, the Cube series of movies. I don't know if you're familiar with those films, Cube and Hypercube.
Yes, Cube.
Crossed with HAL from 2001, you know? It's Cube meets an insane computer who wants to kill you. So I can imagine that
I think when I look at Halo, like when I first actually that Avatar movie, the blue one, not Avatar: The Last Airbender.
Sure.
the moment I saw it, I thought to myself, "Oh, it's Dances with Wolves meets Halo."
Yeah,
which is exactly what it was.
So Halo doesn't excite me as much as the idea of Halo being translated to a movie doesn't excite me as much because James Cameron had did it with Aliens, he did it with Avatar, he's done it to death. I've seen it already.
What do you think about possibly? I mean, like. I look at a property, it's not a video game, but there was one property a couple of years ago which I had hoped would turn into something that you could watch as a live action thing, and that was The Walking Dead. And I look at The Walking Dead, and I look at the HBO series of Game of Thrones, which is based on A Song of Ice and Fire.
Uh-huh.
And I think for some of these bigger properties, I'm actually more attracted to the idea they don't have to be full-fledged shows like the ones I described, but I'm more attracted to the idea of a mini-series that can follow a character without the limitation of an hour and a half to 2 hours. And you know, be high production and be finite. Like a movie is finite, but, you know, like maybe 10 episodes or 7 episodes, that's the whole entire thing. That's it. That's all. Whatever. And I feel like for me, that's the best way to sort of lay these things to rest cinematically.
That sounds like the Walking Dead video game, actually. Have you gotten a chance to play that at all?
Well, I mean, The Walking Dead is a comic book that became a TV show that then became a video game. I don't know if the video game is off the comic book or off the TV show. But what
I think
saying
the video
is,
game is more is closer to the comic, and it's supposedly it's got some high marks. I've played a couple.
Very good. Yeah, I've played it. What I'm saying is when I think to myself about nowadays when I think to myself about properties that I love and getting their expression, I often think that it might even be better not to have them on the silver screen. It might be better to be able to fully explore them from the perspective of the small screen over a longer period of time rather than trying to do the 2 hour thing and then trying to have a sequel a little later. I'm trying to have a sequel like, you know, I want to get away from the Resident Evil problem.
I'd love to see a limited run miniseries of a video game, but you'd have to really sort of get on board. You'd have to get some big money behind it.
Yeah,
you know what game would be actually pretty interesting to see on the big screen? Did you ever play Shadow of the Colossus?
No.
Yeah, I played a little bit of that. Haven't played a lot of that, but
are you familiar with it?
Sure.
Okay, so it's. I think it would actually be a pretty epic sort of film to display on the big screen, especially, you know, you could even keep the original soundtrack, which I think is just amazing. But there's a lot of room to add your own interpretation and context in there because a lot of that game is just basically set in this landscape and discovered by the person who's playing it. But it also has a lot of epic moments and a lot of questioning what's actually occurring, questioning the moves you're making as you go further into the game. So I think it might make an interesting sort of interpretation and something which is different than, you know, the other titles we hear of, you know, Drake's secret, Fortune and things of that nature, the adventure type games. Right. And,
that's interesting. I'd like to. I would have liked to see, like, if I had my way about it, I would have liked to see World War Z, which is a very vignette focused.
Done right.
That would have been, I think, the perfect book to television show, limited run. You know,
done right episodes. As opposed to the way they're doing it now, which is sounds just dreadful.
Yeah. I don't know how it's going to be. I mean, obviously, we will all go see it. So just like no matter what I may have said about Star Wars, we're all going to see it. Yeah.
All right. So let's take a moment here to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And this week's book that I'd like to recommend is Robopocalypse by Daniel Wilson. In the near future, at a moment no one will notice, all the dazzling technology that runs our world will unite and turn against us. A massively powerful artificial intelligence known as Arcos comes online and assumes control over the global network of machines that regulate everything from transportation to utilities, defense, and communication. When the robot war ignites, at a moment later known as Zero Hour, humankind will be both decimated and possibly, for the first time in history, united. Robopocalypse is a brilliantly conceived action epic, a terrifying story with heart-stopping implications for the real technology all around us, and an entertaining and engaging thriller unlike anything written in years. So, it's a little shades of T2, of Terminator 2, for sure. Of Skynet. But this sounds like a really fascinating sci-fi book. I've got it on my short list of books to listen to. If you are interested in this and you want to download that or any of Audible's other 10,000 plus titles, all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. And a 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out Audible's services. If you don't like the book, if you don't like Audible's services, you can cancel and you'll get to keep the book for free. And going to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown helps our show out. So if you haven't already subscribed to Audible, use that URL to join. All right, we're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, is Netflix's full season release schedule the future of television or a big mistake? So take a listen to this and come on back.
Thank you.
you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm Andy Sarcini. I'm speaking with Peter Cerretta, founder and editor-in-chief of SlashFilm.com. On February 1st, Netflix launched their original series House of Cards. Rather than releasing the 12-episode series over sequential weeks, as you might expect from a television network, Netflix decided to release all 12 episodes at once, presumably because as a streaming service they're not bound to a release schedule, and also to leverage the binge viewing habits of modern viewers. You recently engaged in a Twitter debate with House of Cards executive producer Dana Brunetti regarding Netflix's release strategy. Brunetti, naturally, is of the opinion that releasing House of Cards all at once fits into the new model of TV viewing, and some critics are inclined to side with him, calling it the future of television. But you, along with others like Variety's Andrew Wallenstein, think this may be a mistake on Netflix's part. Can you explain what you mean by that?
I didn't plan on becoming this big debate or this big article, but it somehow did. It's just something I've been thinking about for, you know, a while now. When they released Lilyhammer, which I understand is a much smaller release than House of Cards, I saw people talking about it for about, you know, a week or maybe 10 days. My friends talked about it. All of them watched one or two episodes. And then I hadn't heard anybody even mention the name of the program until this week. I was thinking, is that because of the release model? Was it because was it because the show wasn't that great? I mean, it was good enough that they're making a season two, and Netflix obviously thought it was a success for them. But for me, it seems like I live in the, you know, like you, Andy. I live on Twitter. I live on Facebook, and I live in the world of social media where I love discussing everything, and I loved watching Lost, and every week, you know, talking with everybody, seeing all the little, like, you know, animated GIFs that would show up, and like the jokes, and reading the recaps of what things might mean and where things might go, and, you know, like Dave Chen does his Breaking Bad podcast, like listening to, you know, yeah, their theories and stuff. And I feel like you miss out on all of that water cooler conversation by releasing the whole thing in one dump. And I think, in effect, you're missing out on the social media pull. You know, like you can't watch a TV show without having a hashtag in the corner of the screen nowadays on regular television, right, because they want you to talk and tweet about it. So I feel like you're missing out on all that talking, tweeting. I mean, people are talking about it this week, but will they be talking about it next week?
That's a good question. I have to admit that I've binge viewed series like Breaking Bad and The Wire before, and I've had a greater sense of satisfaction than I would have if I'd waited a week for a new episode. But I admit that I might not have been compelled to watch those shows in the first place if I hadn't heard about them through weekly, you know, water cooler social discussion.
Yeah, it's a weird what came first, the chicken or the egg kind of thing. And I'm a person that has binged series myself. I did the first season of 24 in like probably a weekend. Mm-hmm. So it's not like I'm against that. I enjoy binge watching, but I've found that it, with some serialized TV, I enjoy it more. Experiencing it with you know, my group of friends, uh-huh, over a period of time. I'm not sure if a weekly schedule is. I don't feel like I'm a fuddy-duddy either. Like I'm a really tech savvy guy.
Sure.
I'm not sure if releasing all the episodes at once is the smart business thing to do, and it's not for experience point of view or from a consumer experience. I'm not sure if it's the smart thing to do.
Now, one of your points of contention is that you talked about how you've had some experience with secondhand experience with people that you know who have subscribed to HBO, for example, and then watch like all of Game of Thrones and then unsubscribe from HBO afterwards. Yeah. But do you see Netflix subscribers doing the same thing? Because Netflix is not, you know, it's not like HBO has this sort of scheduled programming
that you're either on board with or not. And Netflix is basically, it's all you can eat. There's so much on-demand content. But I feel like people who are already subscribing to Netflix wouldn't necessarily stop subscribing after a season of Arrested Development, for example.
Oh, I agree with you. And I think that's one of the things that I've been thinking about is that who's Netflix trying to appeal to with this binge, with dumping a whole season on demand at once? That binge watching appeal seems to appeal to the people that are already subscribed to Netflix. Mm-hmm. I feel like they're trying, you know, they're spending $100 million for House of Cards for both seasons. And their goal is to get, you know, a ton more subscribers to sign up, not only subscribe to Netflix, but to remain on for at least a year, period. And that's what I have in question. I don't think I'm going to unsubscribe. I've been a Netflix subscriber since, you know, probably the first year of Netflix.
Sure. Since the DVD days.
Yeah. So, like, I'm not going to unsubscribe. And I'm not one of those people that subscribes to, you know, Showtime when Dexter starts and cancels when the finale airs. I'm too lazy. I think there are people out there like that. I mean, there's a 14-day free trial of Netflix. You could subscribe and watch the entire season of House of Cards and then be out without paying one single dollar. I'm not saying everybody's going to do that. That's probably a small minority of people. But it's possible. I just think there's I think there is something to be gained by releasing these in chunks. Even if it was like, you know, releasing four episodes – you know, this month and then four episodes next month in one day. Or yeah. I don't know what the model is. I'm not saying I want this weekly episodic release model to stay. I don't think that I'm not one of those people that is, you know, clings onto the comfort of, you know, tradition. Right. I do think that there is probably a better way. I just don't know what that is
but
in this new social digital world.
So you think that given that this seems to be the way that more content is going to be delivered in the future, you think that audiences will eventually catch up with binge viewing releases, or is the habit of water cooler social viewing too deeply ingrained in us as a culture to change?
I would like to think that it's too deeply connected us to change, especially with Twitter. I feel like, you know, I don't work at an actual workplace where there's an actual water cooler to talk to other employees over. So, you know, I didn't really have these water cooler discussions as much, you know, a few years ago as I do now on Twitter. Twitter is my water cooler.
It's the modern day water cooler.
Yeah, and I feel like I don't know. I just feel like it works so perfectly. And I'm not saying that we all have to watch an episode at the same time and talk about it after. I understand that everybody doesn't have the same schedule, but I feel like by being not in sync, but by offering that ability to not being in sync with everybody, it stifles the conversation, and stifling the conversation. Mm. I mean, it's even interesting, like with some of these websites that do episode recaps, they don't know what to do. So, like, you know, The Onion is doing episode recaps of House of Cards, mm-hmm. and they're doing it weekly as if it was airing weekly,
right?
Because they don't know how else to do it, which is pretty interesting.
They've had to change they've had to conform the new model to their old model of critiquing.
What do you think? I mean, what do you think is the optimal way of doing it?
Well, like I have to say that I'm a big fan of the whole binge viewing thing. Cause I do want to, I love watching something all at once, but I cannot fathom doing a show like Lost, for example, watching a show like Lost where it's released all at once and I don't have that
sort of there are some instances where the delaying gratification is necessary. I think Lost is like one end of the spectrum. Like House of Cards is a perfect example of something that you would want to consume all at once, I feel. So it's tough. I'm really torn. I feel like I'm okay with the one fear that I have about the binge viewing thing is that what you bring up in that you don't necessarily have that shared conversation from week to week. You either have to be on board with you either have to watch the whole thing and then catch up with the conversation afterwards, or not be involved in the social conversation at all. I think I might be actually okay with not being involved with the social conversation. Mm-hmm. I would just want to know that what I'm watching is a quality content. So it's like I'm less inclined to hang in there. Talking specifically about House of Cards, it's a good show, but it's not great. It's not like Arrested Development or The Wire or Breaking Bad. It's a solid show. It's better than Lilyhammer, but I don't know. I'm 3 or 4 episodes into it, and I'm not overwhelmingly compelled to want to keep watching.
It's going to be weird with Arrested Development because I feel like that's more of a cultural phenomenon of a show, and I feel like, you know, the first day it's going to hit at midnight, and that day people are going to be tweeting out all the in jokes and all the like whatever on Twitter, and I'm not going to understand it. So now I'm going to have to take the day off and watch the entire. Do you know what I mean? But what you say does make sense, especially with the quality of the content. Because I binge watched the first season of 24 when it came out.
Uh-huh.
On DVD, and I love 24, the early seasons of 24. But that's a show that if you binge watch it, as much as you're so satisfied to when there's a cliffhanger, you know, immediately satisfy, you know, that tension and hit the next episode and see what happens to Jack Bauer. As much as that's satisfying, the storytelling in 24. I feel like is not satisfactory in a condensed version. The storylines don't seem to make as much sense if you watch it, you know, extended for, you know, months at a time, because you realize, you know, three hours earlier, the person that ended up being the mole was helping Jack Bauer out. That doesn't make any sense. Those realizations occur to you when you watch them back to back, but when you watch it episodically, it seems more you buy it more, and what's weird is, you know, with comic books, I don't read comic books, but I read graphic novels. I just could never get into the cycle of the monthly or every other month, you know, having an issue, and I wouldn't remember what happened in the last issue and whatnot. So I seem to be on the other side of the comic book debate. I would rather, you know, binge read it all in one issue, you know, all in one trade paperback. But I don't know. For some reason, I don't care about the social conversation on that end. But
you know, I think Arrested Development is really going to be the true acid test of this whole model. And I feel like the first thing you're going to hear about when Arrested Development is released is all of the sick days that everyone is going to take. Like the day after it's released.
Oh, definitely.
All right. Thank you very much for your opinion, Peter Serretta. Where can we find your work when you're online?
You can find more of my work at slashfilm.com and at twitter.com/slashfilm. And I just want to say I really love the drill down, and I don't get to listen to it enough, but I try to get to it at least once a month.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
So, Dwayne and Tosin, is Netflix diluting the viral social impact of an extended television season by releasing all episodes at once, or is binge viewing the future of television?
Binge viewing is clearly the future of television.
I don't know if I agree there.
I will give you data. I will give you data. You can refute my data. Okay. I will say that ever since the age of the DVR, when TiVo came out, people have been aggregating TV shows in ways that have frustrated the networks. The networks want you to have the water cooler moment. They want you to all watch at the same time because that means they have enough eyeballs on their screens to get advertisers to pay these ridiculous amounts of money to, you know, that help them produce these shows and take home these record profits. That is a good thing. I don't discount it. But like Andy said earlier on, when he was talking about CBS and CES, if you're going to walk away from what the people want in terms of technology, you're going to get in trouble. And I think that the standard of releasing a television show so that people can only watch it at one time is going away. We've got Hulu now. You can watch a few episodes in a row, or if you have Hulu Plus, you can watch the entire seasons. We've got Netflix, which has broken the mold. Netflix even said the other day, House of Cards is designed so that they become HBO before HBO becomes them.
Right.
Right? HBO's got HBO Go, where these binge sessions happen. Xfinity and Time Warner Cable have video on demand, where these binge sessions happen. People like to shut themselves up in wintertime when it's cold outside, snuggle up with their sweethearts, or if it's on like, you know, the Kids Center or whatever, on Netflix or whatever, snuggle up with their kids and watch multiple episodes of something and kind of be like, wow, I feel accomplished. We saw so much of it. I caught up. That's the phrase. You caught up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what Netflix has done here is they said, we're going to release the TV show, but we're not a network. I mean, we want to create content, but we're going to do it in a manner that is native to the way that we do it. If it were iTunes that, if it was Apple that created a TV show, they would release it one week at a time. You'd buy the season and they'd release it 1 week at a time, because that's how Apple has created the iTunes experience. But the Netflix experience is to acquire content a season at a time and for you to be able to track it down and watch it. Amazon does the same thing with their streaming. So I think if they had made it so that you had to come back and watch House of Cards later, I don't think that would have jived with the Netflix streaming audience, from the perspective that the Netflix streaming audience wants and has shown that they work better. They've got data, metrics, analytics that show how people watch cinema, and I'm sure all of that stuff factored into the way they wanted to present this particular thing. And the second big caveat here, and I was talking to Andy about this before the show, is the talent. When you've got someone like Kevin Spacey on mm-hmm. your television show, Kevin Spacey's a movie guy. We often think that, you know, culturally we still believe that movies they supersede television. I think television's catching up in major ways. We were talking about Game of Thrones. You know, there's still like Band of Brothers. But really, movie stars, they want to work on movies. They want the flexibility of donating 3-4 months of their time toward the principal shooting, walking away, going to the next project while it's all post-production set up. And, you know, they get that. And when you do a TV show like this, when you film the entire show all at once, instead of filming part of it, then having your mid-season break and then filming another part of it. When you do that all at once, you can attract talent like Kevin Spacey because you're producing it in a manner that ties in with his existing lifestyle. So you can get these big names that want they want to be on the edge of stuff. They want to, oh, yeah, it's online. Yeah, it's great, whatever. And I'm getting paid. But they also don't have to leave their current paradigm of content production.
Yeah, you know what? I definitely give Netflix major props for stepping outside the typical bounds of releasing, you know, an episode a week or some sort of schedule. But on another, you know, perspective, I sort of think it may have been smarter to spread them out a little bit, you know, release first 4 episodes in the mm-hmm, first mm-hmm. week or and then wait another week and release another few, primarily because I find that a lot of people get into this sort of mentality where, you know, once a series is out and available, that, oh, well, now that it's there on Netflix, I can always watch it at any other point. That season isn't going anywhere. So mm-hmm. the whole viral nature of releasing a new show, releasing an actual Netflix show, kind of, well, it doesn't last as long. And I think that's also primarily why syndicated TV does it as an episode at a time, because they, as you said, they like that water cooler effect where the conversation is ongoing.
Syndicated TV or network produced TV? Syndicated TV often has like several episodes back to back on like a weekday.
Or network produced TV. Now, I mean, that being said, I think, you know, like I said, I think it's good to release a chunk at a time, because at that point people will, you know, we do like to binge to a certain extent, but I don't think anyone's binging. I think the
you're looking for a hybrid approach.
Who are right,
you're
exactly.
You get that people like to watch four episodes at a time, and I think you're right. I don't know about you, Andy, but anecdotally, I would say that when I really get into something, especially if you're with somebody else, it's usually around three to four episodes at a time. That's what catching up is. You haven't seen it for a month because it's been a busy month for you. You catch up at four episodes. And I would agree with you, Tosin. I think that you have a really good idea here. The only issue that I would see facing this is that the content has to accommodate that four-episode run. So you have to, rather than just have a cliffhanger at the end of every episode, you have to find some way to have some sort of mini arc that leaves people satisfied enough to want to turn it off and leave it until the next time it shows up again.
That's true.
Part of the argument that I brought up with Peter Serretta was that I have benefited from binge viewing series like The Wire or Breaking Bad, you know, all at once. However, I might not have even been aware of those shows or the impact of those shows in the first place had I not been involved in the ongoing week-to-week social discussion online.
Really? Because I found that, I think back in maybe 2004, I started watching Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I think it ended in 2003. I had seen a couple episodes of it before, but I really got into it. And I didn't know, Twitter wasn't a thing back then, back when Buffy was out between 97 and 2004. But being able to watch it on its own without other people's input, in some ways, I think, gave me more insight into the impact of this particular television show on other bits of content that I came across. The fact that Joss Whedon was able, because I knew the air dates as I watched it, right? So the fact that like you're able to see how like the character arc and the story arcs grow in ways that are then emulated on newer TV shows, things like that. So I think it's there's something to be said about joining the social conversation, and that's valid. I just feel as if that's not the only way to do it. You can be successful, highly successful, if you've got people who want to watch it all at once. And let's look at Josh Whedon's other show, Firefly. I don't have raw data, but I would guess most people I know saw that TV show on DVD in like the year 2005, whenever the DVDs came out. Like, they didn't see it. One of the reasons why it failed was because people didn't see it when it was on air. They saw it as a DVD. I guess it was before 2005. That's when Serenity came out. But they saw the DVD episodes in DVD order.
Yeah.
You know, and it was, 10 episodes or 13 episodes or something like that? So people were really like, oh, I'm going to watch Firefly this weekend. Or I was at my friend's house and we started watching Firefly and we just didn't stop. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's a show that there were no commercials. There were no whatever. And that's part of this whole experience. This idea that when you're consuming TV, especially if it's heady TV, a Battlestar Galactica, a House of Cards, a West Wing, the idea that you're not stopping for the advertisements in the middle because you paid for it already or whatever, I think that's really helpful. And you're not going to run into that when it comes to cable TV shows, which we can liken Netflix to. But you will run into that problem when you're looking at the big four networks, premieres and TV shows. And I think that part of that cinematic experience comes from that batch of continuity and that excitement when you're watching it and you know you have to pee, but you're watching it with three of your friends and you're all going to hold out until like just the end of that particular episode, and then all you're going to run and use the bathroom and like get a drink of water and whatever, and you can get back right into it. You know, that kind of stuff still happens. So I don't know that you need the super social, ridiculously viral situation in order to really have a TV show express its full weight.
I really hope that Netflix can shake the foundations, because, I mean, wouldn't this be pretty awesome if it ends up working as like a business model too, in terms of, you know, driving content creators to their venue and being able to continually release high quality shows. Mm-hmm. Now, what I'm actually sort of curious is, what is the model going to be for individuals who choose to review these?
That's a good question.
These shows, like, is it the sort of thing where you have to watch the full season before you can set a review?
I think you have to.
Episodes, or
I think,
like,
one you have to, and I think we should care less. We should care less about the reviewers, because it's not about the world. It's not about their opinions as much as it's about how much people can enjoy these shows. So I think the reviewer should do a lot less in terms of saying, I guess reviewers want to curate things, but the commitment has to be more. And maybe, you know, like, they're gonna get a little less out of it because they won't be able to review each show one at a time because it's not being released one at a time. Their schedules are gonna be a little off. But I really feel as if it's their job then to recommend the show, or insofar as saying, yeah, it starts off wonderfully, it peters out toward the middle, that kind of thing. As opposed to just, you know, being able to live off the fat of, oh, it came out this week, I'm going to review it this week, you know, that kind of thing. We have to challenge that aspect of the media as well.
The AV Club's solution to that problem is they are reviewing it on a week-to-week basis as if it was a weekly release show.
Interesting.
That's crazy, because people will be like, oh, I saw that already. You guys are behind. What are you doing? This is ridiculous. I mean, that's if you're someone who's an advocate of this kind of digital distribution, that's what you're going to think, you know? I think the big winner here are going to be websites like the Wikipedia. How many times have you been binge-watching a show, maybe missed something or not got something, popped open the Wikipedia and read the synopsis? Because the Wikipedia has this great thing where the info box of the TV show will include this, like, episodes. It'll say, like, 15 episodes. And then it'll be a link to just the page about the episodes. How weird, you know. That's a crazy – and that's free. I don't know.
It'll be really interesting to see what happens also with, like, spoilers and things like that. You know, what's kind of crazy is look at what Netflix has been doing. Remember when, like, everyone was like, oh, they need to oust their CEO, Reed Hastings, and the apology they had and their downswing that Netflix had a few years ago? Look where they are now.
It was a year and a half ago, yeah. No, I think there's something to the fact that, well, Reed Hastings is a founder, and sometimes founders flounder. But what often happens is that the vision that they have for their company is usually pretty out there compared to the status quo. You look at Mark Zuckerberg, the social is the norm. He said it years before that was the case. And they're extremists in some ways. And that's what makes them people with the vision to found these disruptive companies. I mean, not only did he have the vision of saying, hey, let's beat Blockbuster by not having stores and send the discs to people, he got into the streaming video game early enough so that the people who actually own the content didn't completely or fully understand the value of the content, which is why he got such great deals and was able to get the inroads that he got. You know, when they bought Mad Men from AMC for like $112 million, people thought they were crazy, but it also put him on the map. So I think Reed Hastings had definitely, like, he screwed up with the whole we're going to separate it and everything like that. Mm-hmm. But I think he was also his actual, like, you know, what he's done properly far outweighs what he's done not properly. And I think that's been borne out. He's also got good people around him now. I guess we were talking about J.J. Abrams, who he's probably listening to a little bit more closely these days, who are helping him achieve this dream in a way that doesn't piss off the users.
Yeah. You know, there's also a lot of articles coming up within the last few hours of, like, you know, Disney CEO says Netflix deal won't hurt cable business, or Netflix is not a threat, says the Time Warner CEO. I wonder how much they're actually concerned.
Yeah, well, we heard the Time Warner CEO, not the current one, but the previous one, say something like it wasn't a threat that most of the people under the age of 30 were getting their content without paying, you know, they were just buying internet, you know. So we'll see how it all works out. But I think if you're a public company especially, you've got to speak with lots of confidence about your business model when new upstarts, and Netflix is slowly, quickly becoming not an upstart but a standard. But if you're like a traditional company, you've got to tell your shareholders in no uncertain terms that what you're doing is fine and there's no reason to worry.
All right, we're going to take another little break here, but when we come back, will your body, or any living organism for that matter, be the next unlimited storage device? Take a listen to this and come on back. you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Sorsini, and I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Unifowaken. Scientists in Britain have announced a breakthrough in the quest to turn DNA into a revolutionary form of data storage that could fit the world's entire 3 billion terabytes of stored data in the palm of your hand. They said a speck of man-made DNA could hold mountains of data that could be freeze-dried, shipped, and stored, potentially for thousands of years. The contents are read by sequencing the DNA, as is routinely done today, in genetic fingerprinting and so on, and turning it back into computer code. The study reported that the Institute's team had stored all 154 Shakespeare sonnets, a photo, a PDF of a scientific paper, and a 26-second sound clip from Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech in a barely visible bit of DNA in a test tube. We downloaded the files from the web and used them to synthesize hundreds of thousands of pieces of DNA. The result looks like a tiny piece of dust, said Emily LaProust of Agilent, a biotech company that took the digital data and used it to synthesize molecules of DNA in a lab in the U.S. Agilent then mailed the sample across the Atlantic to where researchers soaked it in water to reconstitute it, and using standard sequencing machines to unravel the code, they recovered and read the files with 100% accuracy. It's also incredibly small, dense, and doesn't need any power for storage, so shipping and keeping it is easy.
I think they said 50 million gigabytes or something like that could fit in something the size of a granola bar.
That's insane.
50 million megabytes, yeah. Could fit in the size of a granola bar or some nonsense like that. Mm-hmm. So this is great. I mean, we watched the so-called futuristic stuff in the 60s,
right,
where it was like just add water. And that's really what happened with this data. And if you think about it, it's hilarious, but it makes a lot of sense. The science that's working here isn't some man-made conjecture. The simple fact of the matter is, if you understand the neo-Darwinism and the Mendelian nature of evolution, mm-hmm, you get that there is a common ancestor that was probably a single-celled organism, and that the reason why between RNA and DNA, the reason why the proteins that exist to make us what we are,
yeah,
exist because they are basically super efficient data storage,
yes,
and data processing devices. Data is everything. I mean, I say it all the time, but like literally, the idea that every single cell has it just expresses what it needs to express, but it has the entire copy,
yeah,
the body politic of the human body, which we're still trying to figure out.
Right.
Means that the simple shit, like, uh-huh, writing things down or laying things out or, you know, the architectural whatevers, that's stuff that can be recorded not by ones and zeros, but by the fundamental protein, pieces of DNA, A, T, C, and G. So
fascinating? It's a testament to the sort of the genetic efficiency of life, of organic life, is that how much data is transmitted by nature, and now we have the ability to manipulate that medium to carry our own data. It's funny. Like I was thinking,
talk about metadata.
Oh, seriously, seriously. Well, you know, when I read about this, I thought about. I thought back to William Gibson's short story, Johnny Mnemonic, and how like the character in that movie was a living hard drive that he would memorize something and then encode it into his brain. And then he would travel from one place to another, and then he'd have to remember like a mnemonic code that would unlock whatever it is that he memorized. This is a quantum leap beyond that. He doesn't have to the carrier of this information doesn't have to remember anything because they
may not even know they're a carrier.
Exactly.
I think the opening two-part series of Enterprise, Star Trek's, last and I guess failed
incarnation.
A television show incarnation.
Sure.
There was a courier that had to be delivered to the Klingon Empire. And in the end, what he was delivering was schematics or plans or whatever evidence that was encoded into his genetic stream, into his genetic sequence, which is a lot of work. But, mm-hmm. you know, to re-encode a living being's genetic situation. Even in Blade Runner, they would talk about once a being has, you know, been alive, like re-encoding it is horrible, is can't be done, sure. that kind of thing. But the idea that you can do this isn't, to me, the exciting part. The idea is that, like, it's becoming somewhat feasible to do this. Like, you add this to the coming age of 3D printers, and in 50, 60 years, you can have, like, the most nuanced, most amount of data, whatever, mm-hmm. that's available, you know, like, being used to create incredibly complex things. Imagine using this, the ability to read and write genetic code from a genetic perspective will make us more versed at how we do things like build organs. So imagine using like a 3D printer to build an organ. Imagine making Lilu in The Fifth Element.
Right. Right.
You know?
Right. Like 3D printing your own Lilu.
Exactly. Given
the biomass. Yeah. All you need
don't
is
want to
biomass.
Be that explicit. Yeah.
I never imagined that Luc Besson was so prescient, but there you go. I mean, that's actually fairly prescient for what we're talking about here.
Hey, man, those Montecchiwans knew what was up, and I just feel like this is exciting. I really feel like what's exciting to me is the idea that I read a lot of futurist stuff, and I saw this one thing where this guy was talking about in the future, your computer, I mean, people like me and Tosin, we build our own. And imagine your computer isn't something that you build and then like it stays how it is and you like maybe throw a new processor in it. Imagine it's more like a tree, right? And as it's processing data, it has the ability to process data stored in genetic code. You store your data in genetic code. And as it gets older, based on the energy you give it, it grows, not unlike a plant would. So it's going to grow new data storage devices. It's going to, the idea that it's a living machine. Maybe not a sentient one, but certainly like a living one. And those kinds of ideas excite me because the idea that you can store stuff in genetic code is almost as exciting as the idea that you could one day possibly like your storage mechanism is a vat of gelatinous stuff that is, you know, code that's like being read by, you know, by what's it called? Why can't I? Enzymes. Like enzymes, the same enzymes that unwrap and rewrap DNA are working in real time to deliver the data to your processor in order for you to like do what you have to do. So you can, depending on like, you know, how much parallel processing you have going, you can unwrap, you know, gad amounts of data. Mm-hmm. The funniest thing is, no matter how easy it is to store something, I mean, we were all there when the 120 gigabyte WD drive came out back in the year 2000. Mm-hmm. We were like, you'll never fill that up. But like, here we are. Tosin just built a NAS with it's 6 terabytes with a full redundancy, so 3 terabytes a piece. And like, you know, like we will find a way to make DNA, to strain DNA's capacity.
Yeah.
There will be a 350, you know, petabyte drive,
yeah.
the size of your fingernail. And you'll be like, damn, I am out of space, yeah. man. I don't know. Like, that freaking 24K video just ate up all the space.
All you need to do is to generate a life-size, real-time model of the Earth, and that DNA will be depleted like that. That DNA storage will be depleted like that. You know what the interesting thing about this is that this news combined with the other stuff that we've been talking in the past, like the Pebble and the Fitbit, and all of the, this is like we're reaching this singularity of transhumanism, you know, where we're
convergence.
Yes. This convergence where it's going to be difficult to separate who we are from our technology.
Everyone is, I mean, all these people have always said it's going to be wearable computers, it's going to be this. And the fact is, I've never been keen on the idea of silicon implanted into my flesh. But if you can implant organic components mm-hmm. that can carry out data processing and other other things that we associate with computers now, I would feel much better about that. If telepathy, being able to, or like being able to speak without speaking, being able to like, hey, Andy, I'm saying what's up, but I'm not opening my mouth.
Right.
If that can be created by an organic component, an organ that mm-hmm. can be inserted into you, and that can like, you know, communicate via, I don't know, radio waves or whatever to somebody else, and that's how we move forward. I mean, that would be ideal, as opposed to the Johnny Mnemonic or the Matrix idea where you've got plastic and metal infused into some part of your brain. That sounds like an infection waiting to happen.
Well, I mean, we'll all get cancer before then anyway, so.
Maybe we'll have a way to not get cancer, because finally we don't need like the, you know, like how there's like those screensavers, the folding?
Yeah.
You know, like the fold. Maybe right. If we have DNA as a storage device and we have enzymes as processing devices for that DNA, we'll move them that much faster. The computers will be like, you know, molecularly based.
Sure.
And we won't have to fold, and maybe we'll get rid of cancer with this technology. Mm-hmm. I mean,
unless the computers gain awareness and then go to sleep. Right?
Yes. You don't want them going to sleep. That's the way to kill humanity. What happens is they wake up and, oh, this is really fucking boring. But yeah, so I mean, this is really exciting. I do think that the convergence between your life and your technology, the miniaturization of it, the wearing of it, the tracking of things. I mean, like, you talked about Fitbit and you talked about the other stuff. What does Fitbit do? Fitbit tracks your physical, corporeal existence, right. And it makes a metric out of it. And then you're able to work against that metric. You're able to take that data and work against it. And, you know, whether it's like Nike Fuel Band, whatever you want to do, the idea is that you're using the technology to make your body better. And now we're seeing that we're able to use parts of the body to make technology better.
Right.
And it's, right. It's nice.
Any other thoughts on this before we sign off?
Did you, sort of an aside, did you guys see that article about a Fitbit hack, which kind of cuts power to different gear of yours if you're not working out?
No.
So, like, it can cut power to your fridge and or your TV or things of that nature if you're not working out. It's an interesting hack, kind of more of a proof of concept,
I think that's a scary portend of the future of, you know, this convergence tech.
Hey, well, if you read Ready Player One,
right,
there's a great scene where, you know, they all live on this thing called the Oasis, but this one guy, the author took some time to say how he was like a fat slob, and he got a program that basically made him do physical fitness on a regular basis, or else it would shut down his ability to get online, which is the lifeblood for everything. And so he developed a routine in which he was able to actually, you know, become incredibly fit by the standards of the day, and still maintain his, like, you know, 16-hour-a-day online presence. So, you know, that might be where we're going. And if you want to get 1984 on that jammy, you know, it all ties in, right? The socialist government tells you that you must be this fit or else you can't get online to do whatever you have to do, and you do it.
Okay, so first of all, I want to thank Peter Cerretta for joining us this week and letting us interview him. And let me go around the table here and ask you, starting with you, Dwayne, where can we find your work online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can find me on twitter.com/DwayneD, DwayneD. You can also go to flavors.me/DwayneD and see what I'm up to, whether it's Twitter, pictures, what I'm reading, things like that. And I'm working on a new startup that's coming out in a couple of weeks, and so you'll probably see me there when that happens. Right. So I'll give you guys more word on that when it shows up.
And Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find you online when you're not here?
You can find me and my musings on twitter.com/toast4321, T-O-A-S-T 4321, as well as you can find me discussing irresponsible random things on ircwebcast.blogspot.com.
As for myself, you can find me at mrbabyman.com, or just do a Google search for Mr. Babyman, and you can find all my social links there, Facebook and Twitter and so on. Check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network, by going to geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes. If you go to geeksofdoom.com, our iTunes link is in the right-hand sidebar. Our show is on Stitcher. You can listen to us on your iPhone, Android, Kindle Fire, and other devices by going to Stitcher.com. Add us on Facebook, facebook.com/TheDrillDown, and Twitter, twitter.com/TheDrillDown. If you get an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@TheDrillDown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on The Drill Down. Let The Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location when our guest will be Reddit's top user Scopolamina, with tips and tricks to help you gain success on Social News' number one website. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
Well, here we are again. It's always such a pleasure. Remember when you tried to kill me twice? Oh, how we laughed and laughed. Except I wasn't laughing. Under the circumstances, I've been shockingly nice. You want your freedom?